I'm not putting the pressure on myself to come up with a funny cold open for our very last episode of the year.
You see, yeah. For breakfast, I like to take the egg and the steam and the steam and the egg.
That's reductive.
That's reductive. That's reductive. Let me try. I love wheat because it makes my poops better. Here's a little information about my poops.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty close. That's pretty
Justin, here's a picture of my rotten toe that you've begged me to stop sending you. Yet I continue to send pictures of the rotten toe. And I send them in a style like it is an automated service that I have subscribed to.
Sometimes text conversations with Russ turn into like a shock image, like something awful forum thread. It's like, Look at all the poop that my baby did on the wall today. It's like, dog.
I know that you did not invite this at all.
It's good because this is all stuff that has not necessarily been highlighted on the podcast. So it's good that people understand that there are depths to me that aren't just.
Yeah, by the end of this show, I want the Besties subtitle to be a full cataloging of the failures of Russ Rushdick. this is... one that Russ said in July when I was talking about his son. Russ texted out of the blue and said, it's pretty wild how big he's gotten. It goes pretty fast. And I said, thinking he was talking about his son, I said, yeah, enjoy it as much as you can. People always say that, but you should always do that all the time, I think. You know, like try to enjoy it as much as you can. And Russ said, yeah, I'm trying to. Here's how far we've come. And then he sent me 5 time-coded pictures of his rotten toe, beginning in September of 2020 and ending in July 21.
It's almost healed, for what it's worth.
Yeah, great. We were all on fucking pins and needles.
Yeah.
I'll be real. I'm just kind of sad. I thought he was only sending this stuff to me. I thought we had something special.
He's been, you know what's fucked up? He's been making me pay for it. He keeps saying, here's this text chain is my OnlyFans, and now PayPal me $5.
No free foot pics.
I guess so.
My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best game of the year.
I mean, my name's Griffin McElroy. I'm not going to say I know the best game of the year. That's the point of the whole episode. So I'm not like a psychic.
My name is Christopher Thomas Plant, and you know, every game is a winner.
My name is Russ Frostick, and I know the best game of the week.
Welcome to the Besties, where we talk about the latest and greatest in home interactive entertainment. It is a video game club, and just by listening, you, my friend, have become a member. We began our end of the year battle last episode. If you haven't listened to that, you probably should. And we are down to a final 8 games, and we're going to pit them against each other, and then again, and then again. So that's basically the flow. If you've never done a bracket before, that's how it goes.
I'm sure all of our listeners have done some sort of sports bracket at some time in their life.
Mm-hmm. When I think our listeners, I think sports brackets.
Well, I mean, I do sports brackets sometimes, and I'm a pretty big geek because it turns all the guys into like video game characters.
That's
it's
true.
It's like Drew Brees is the paladin, but he doesn't play anymore, does he?
Unclear.
Okay, this is the wrong crowd to ask.
He doesn't. I can assure you he's
I know
he's
Chris
a commentator
Plant knows
now.
This shit. Guys, Chris Plant is secretly, and I know this because we share a text message chain with a lot of sportsos. Chris Plant's a secret sportso in
Love
a major
sports.
Way.
It's not so sports.
He's not secret.
It's not
about
secret.
It. I guess
it's
so.
He's got like the outfits and everything.
He's rubbing that's it in true. Everybody's face. Well, anyway, that's been some fun flavor. Now we're going to take a brief break and come back and talk to you about the best games of the year.
Can I ask a question before we start?
Yeah.
Do any of you actually have a game, and don't say it because I don't want a spoiler, do you have a game in your heart that you want to win that you think is a game of the year? Because this is the first year that I don't.
I do.
I don't.
I have an inkling, but I would say most of these games I would be perfectly fine walking away having won.
Would say there's maybe like 3 or 4 on here that I would be like, pretty happy with.
Is that a good thing? Like, I don't. I
think that's a good thing.
I think
last year I was totally willing to go to the mat for like Animal Crossing, because I adored that game and thought it was like culturally important in the moment. And that was like, you know, I feel like I usually do have that for at least one game.
Let's kick it off.
First matchup.
Metroid Dread versus Wildermyth.
Okay.
God, that's hard right away.
Well, oofa let me doofa. I want to clarify one very small thing, because I took Plant to task on one element that I was incorrect in the last episode.
Oh.
I claimed that there were only three handwritten campaigns in Wildermyth. There are actually five. Huh. So I did diminish the amount of actual pre-written content that is in Wildermyth. I apologize for that. It's a dope-ass game.
Someone talk about Metroid Dread and why it should win, and someone talk about Wildermyth and why it should win. I would love to do that for Metroid, because I just think it's a badass, a really, really badass game in a way that like I would not describe Metroid games in the past. I would describe them as like atmospheric with a sense of wonder and discovery with cool power-ups, whereas Metroid Dread routinely had moments that had me like jumping out of my seat, like heart pounding, you know, moments that I don't know that this series, I did not know that this series could evoke. Mm-hmm. It is like a really good action game. It feels great. Runs at 60 frames, right? Like it is butter smooth. And I just from the moment I picked it up and started to like counter enemies and like had my first interaction with one of the Emmy robots, it checks all the boxes that a Metroid game needs to check. Mm-hmm. Of being clever and, you know, having a cool world to inhabit and explore. But on top of that, like, it was some of the best action that a video game sort of provided to me for the entire year.
Yeah, I think it's pretty, maybe the most standout aspect of it. There have been a number of games that have been made in 2D, you know, 2.5D, but like that side-scrolling perspective. I don't think there's a game that feels better to move around the world in than Metroid Dread of those 2D games.
All the amazing power-ups like go into that, like the, you know, you get like a phase dash that you can like chain three times in the air, so that like by the end of the game, you are just sort of like, your feet don't have to touch the ground. You just like teleport through the air and speed dash and, screw attack jump and like do all of these things. And you know, the puzzles that utilize that stuff, while like completely unnecessary, unless you're trying to go for a 100% run, which I very much tried to do. It's just so slick. It is just such a slick game that is much more difficult than really any Nintendo franchise is like willing to experiment with, which with some really good boss fights, some really like tense stealth sequences that actually work.
And I also want to give it props for being very smart about how it handles its narrative. Metroid has screwed this up in the past with games like Other M, where it's like, oh, you want a ton of cutscenes with a ton of dialogue and a ton of internal monologue from Samus. That's what you're looking for. No, we are not. We are looking for Samus to be a total fucking badass and crush the world under her boot. And also, you know, have some feelings. That's fine. But you don't need to talk about all your feelings all the time.
You should
be a fucking badass sometimes.
You don't need to talk about your feelings all the time. That's what Metroid's really about.
That's really, yeah. It creates like an arch nemesis that is like genuinely imposing and like,
without being like totally drowning in lore and like mythos shit where you can't follow anything that's going on.
Right.
There's a little bit, but like it's just enough in my opinion. Yeah.
You hear the word Chozo like five times and that's it. You hear Chozo and it's the rest of the games, you hear that and you're like, the spicy meat.
Here we go.
Yeah. It's my favorite sausage. Okay. Wildermyth.
Justin, did you play more this week?
I did.
Can you talk about it then? Because I want somebody new to talk about it.
So I feel like this is an interesting game where a lot of people's experiences are going to be pretty different. And I think that makes it a little more challenging to talk about. But Wildermyth, what I sort of didn't get about it early on and what I kind of dig now is when you start playing Wildermyth, it feels kind of basic. It feels a little bit like My First Adventure. Mm-hmm. Like the mechanics aren't that challenging or complicated. And as a result, like, it can feel sort of unfair. Like, characters can get killed, like, pretty quickly. As far as I can tell, healing is not, like, a big thing. I don't – if there's a healing person or way of doing that, I have not discovered
it. Yeah, it comes across later.
Okay. But – so that can feel very basic. But I think what's cool about it is the story – and these events that you come across in Wildermyth, like, are pretty unpredictable, and they can bend things in a way that, like, you don't expect. And that's cool because it doesn't just feel like you are creating the story yourself. It feels like things are happening that you are not prepared for, in a way that, like, feels un-video gamey, right? Because it can feel like things are unfair sometimes. Like, wait, I didn't want that to happen. But that feels closer to, like, the collaborative spirit of, like, a D&D, where with traditional game design, people are making something that is satisfying and fun to play moment to moment, and they have an arc that you want to go on. And I think Wildermyth is interesting because the game can kind of be pulling you in one direction, and you can kind of pull in a different way. And that ebb and flow, I think, makes for something that feels, it can feel more chaotic, but when things line up, it feels, the moments where it lands, where it's like a satisfying story thing happens that you, to a character where it, like, feels good, or like a character that is important to you manages to survive an encounter and then some weird story thing happens, it feels more satisfying because it feels more organic. It feels like, oh, this is just unique to me. And I really think that that's very cool and effective. It also does a really good job of when a character does die, which can happen, especially early. When I was playing, it happened fairly frequently. They can bring in somebody new, and they sort of integrate them in the story in interesting ways. Like, they feel like a sort of fresh infusion of energy, and, like, story beats can happen to that person very quickly, in a way that, like, endears you to them pretty quickly. Like, so it doesn't just feel like a interchangeable, you know, cast of characters. It tries to build the character and your connection to them really quickly.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing magic trick that they've, I mean, it's not a magic trick. It's incredibly good writing and smart game design that they've sort of made here. I absolutely love those aspects of it. I still find it hard to sort of, and I understand why, but the art design is, like, super not for me. Yeah. I understand It's built to be modular, so you can really, like, slot in and out various things, and it allows the system to work the way it should work, which is, like, pretty scalable, and you can change encounters without changing a lot of the art. That is, I think, still the hardest thing to sort of get over, because it does have, like, almost a flash gamey era vibe to it, even though there's a lot of depth to the writing and the gameplay. You
touched on the writing. It is exceptionally strong.
Yeah.
It walks a really interesting balance between, like, sort of buttoned down high fantasy, like Tolkien-esque, like, you know, the forces of evil are aligning against you and this stuff. And then in the character interactions, it strikes a much more humanist beat. Like, it feels like real people that, you know their backgrounds, like, which is another cool element of this. Like, you see these people come up from a farmer and, you know, somebody working at a shop or a baker or whatever, and you watch their evolution, and, like, it doesn't lose that in the character interactions, which is cool. Like, it makes them feel like real people.
Yeah. It also doesn't go into parody for, like, the humor moments or the lighter moments where, you know, that happens sometimes where it's just like, oh, this is just a parody of something else. But here, it is humorous in the way, again, that Lord of the Rings is, where they'll have that light moment of, like, Merry and Pippin fucking around. And it's, like, fun. It doesn't, like, distract from the overarching evil Sauron story. It's just, like, kind of a way to have a breather.
Yeah, I think it's not just that it doesn't do parody. It doesn't do meta, which I think is something that a lot of D&D fantasy stuff deals with right now.
Sure.
Where it's like, oh, can you believe it? They're in this world, but they make some pun about Spider-Man or something. I don't know.
Thank you, Plant, for that very thorough dissembling of much of my life's work. really, really just sort of. It's
pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
You don't make puns about Spider-Man.
I you have not guarantee listened to you our show. 100% certainty.
Oh,
we have made puns about Spider-Man.
Hey, look, you know what? You started the trend.
That's not true either. But we'll.
Some people just get to be first. You're right. Some people just get to make the mold, you know?
It's hard for. I did not like the tactics element of the game. I did not think that that was. And maybe that's just not my genre. Because I've had a lot of games that I've been super into that have been kind of. I think about the Banner Saga a lot. I don't know if you all played that. That had a kind of, I would say, somewhat similar tactics element to it. And for me, like, I have a very specific thing I want out of that. And it looks like, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics or Fire Emblem or something like that. And I don't get that out of this game. And I find it just kind of, after a few encounters, I find it all to be kind of samey. Yeah.
See, I thought that at first, too. And the more I played, it was interesting because my connection to the characters and I think the way the game wants you to play started to align more where like in a typical game like this, I would send the warrior in by themselves to go attack the thing. Right. But in this one, I'm being like much more cautious about like, OK, we're going to move as a group because if we're close together, we'll be harder to hurt. And then but you still have to like line up. You know, your spellcaster has to have like line of sight to something that they can infuse with. And that was the one that really I loved this, like right before we started recording, actually, there was like a huge monster in a barn that was about to wipe everybody. And my spellcaster was like far outside the barn, but just managed to like infuse with a stone object in the barn. And then from that stone object cast a spell called Discus, which like made us like, you know, blew off some of the stone to hurt the monster and managed to kill it before it could hurt everybody else. But it was like, it was just sort of by the skin of my teeth. And I actually liked the tactics more because I started really worried, like, cause I got burned enough by people just like getting killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think also the tactics and the writing, I don't think either of them, no, I don't know how to say this. The writing is excellent. The story is, when it works amazingly. When it doesn't work, it's because it is a, you know, procedurally generated narrative. Same with the tactics. When it works, it's great. This is not, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics. It is not designed to be the, you know, like most in-depth tactics game ever. I think what makes the game special is both of those things are good enough that they can play with each other, and that is what the game is. That I feel like I just like went full Inception on my own brain. So maybe that didn't make any sense whatsoever.
No, but I
think that we're at a point where we need to.
Yeah, there's one other thing I want to say because I don't want that the slander lingering. I understand why some people bounce off the art. For me, I really have grown to like the art. I like how much it doesn't look like everything else in video games, and that has this kind of paper doll aesthetic. I find it like really comforting in the way that I find like colored pencil art comforting.
It has old webcomic feel in a way that I the art doesn't bother me as much because I used to read a lot of old webcomics. So I think this game is really special. I spent some more time with it over the past week and I'm glad it exists because I have always sort of thought that it is genuinely impossible to capture the feel of actual tabletop pen and paper role-playing games in a video game just because like of the level of how dynamic that experience is in real life and how it's impossible for a pre-programmed piece of software to accomplish that. But I think Wildermyth might just be the game that has come closest to date.
I think if people like this and they like how earnest and human and like loving this is for its characters, the like very first thing that they should check out is this podcast called The Adventure Zone. There's also an illustrated book that I'm just saying I think people will like it. I want people to check out your life's work.
Let me, because I think this is going to be actually pretty painful. I don't know if it'll be a difficult debate because I really do feel torn about this. I'll tell you where I'm at personally is like I really, really like both of these games. I feel like Metroid Dread is more consistently successful in what it is doing, which like Wildermyth is a lot more uncharted territory. And as like when it works, it really, really works, but it's got enough sort of missteps that I am willing to lean towards Metroid Dread. It kind of reminds me of Disco Elysium in that way, where it's like, oh, this is all very cool. I'm like very into this and I'm so excited that it's happening and I feel like it'll inspire other people. But like Metroid Dread is just like more consistently successful for me.
Before we move forward with that logic, if that's the logic that we're going to end up using across the podcast, Inscription is in for a world of pain.
Well, I would just say like, if that's the logic that Justin is using.
We don't need to get there.
Everyone, I'm just saying.
With your heart, you can have any rationale for voting for something.
I'm just saying, if we're going to have any consistency where it's like, it tried, but who, it, you know, it
there's no consistency.
Missed. Okay. Yeah,
there's no consistency.
As long as I know that. I want some expectations set where we say the exact opposite for that game.
I think Metroid Dread rips ass and should be considered.
Yeah, I vote for Metroid Dread as well. I'm sorry, Wildermyth, but it's one of the best 2D games ever made, and I love it.
Juice?
Yeah.
No, yeah, what? I think Metroid Dread.
Look, Metroid Dread had the most levels, so therefore...
It had more levels and, can I say, more guns?
More guns.
A lot more guns.
Okay, can I do Halo Infinite?
Yeah.
Yes.
Halo Infinite is... I was not expecting much from a new Halo game. And Halo Infinite, I have detailed on this podcast, you can go listen to it, the extent to which I love the multiplayer of this in a way that like I never really expected to. But I have been so deeply entranced by it, dozens of hours. I mean, I absolutely love it. The campaign I have now put a lot of time into, and it's just so smart about finding like what is fun about Halo and what is good about Halo, and then like letting you discover those moments like in the world in a way that like, when you are, you have a grappling hook, right? And you're just like, you can just like grapple up a cliff, which feels very un-Halo, but it's like, it's fun with the mechanics that they have built. And when you come across a group of enemies, even if there's not like something around that you want, they're just so fun to like engage with. And that I just like, will stop and fight whoever, because it's like that pleasurable. I love the way that they have made an open world where the rewards feel consequential. I love that you can get multiplayer skins in the single player game. That's so smart. Like it's a really nice unlockable and thing to chase down if you feel like it. I think that having an open world, this is also like something that I think is very strong about Halo. Halo has for the past several iterations had like equipment as a factor, right? So you like in this one, there's a drop shield that you can drop wherever. There's the grappling hook. There's a sort of like quick dash that you can use, and a couple of others. I think what is really cool is because the open world puts you into different scenarios that are not just like traditional video game levels, it really encourages you to use that equipment because you are confronted with like a very different scenario from each encounter. Like there are times when, wow, I really am going to use this drop shield that I would not typically use in a single player campaign. I'm going to use this drop shield because where I'm positioned and where I've encountered this fight, it would make it a lot easier for me. And like, I think that having the dynamic encounters like that encourages you to mix up your tactics. Same with the guns. Like, in single player, I would traditionally in Halo games, I would find a few combos that I liked and stick with them. But here, the different encounters that you run into and the way that you encounter different weapons, it really encourages you to like mix it up, like find the right gun for the situation that you are in. And I think that makes all of it like a lot more satisfying. And I am so impressed with the way that they have taken what is cool about Halo and brought it into the modern world, I think is so, so cool and smart, and I really adore it.
Okay, so you talked a lot about the campaign, which I want to talk about as well. It takes like half hour to get to the open world area of the campaign, and I think we talked a little bit about it when we initially talked about Halo Infinite, that intro part, you know, is weirdly linear and there's not a lot going on, but once you get to the open world, it is like mind-blowingly fun to move around that world and use all the Halo tools and totally crush it. There's something very weird going on in the Halo campaign specifically regarding anything that isn't in that open world, both from a like level design standpoint, just like you go through a lot of blue tubes in that game, like a weirdly large amount, just like very linear 2B type levels, that it just like feels tacked on to the point where I was like looking forward to going back to the open world and not doing story related stuff because it just didn't really fit. It's fun to do shooting, but not when I like have very limited mobility in those areas. Secondarily, I think narratively, it's a pretty big failure. It does not tell a cogent story for, you know, Master Chief or Cortana or really any of the characters in this game. Look, I understand the limitations of Halo as a storytelling medium. In my opinion, there hasn't really been very many super compelling Halo stories told, although I'm not a diehard fan. I don't read the books, so I apologize. But this game takes a lot of swings from a narrative structure standpoint, using flashbacks and stuff like that to try to imply that there's something deeper going on here. But in fact, it all sort of just does not coalesce into a meaningful or impactful story. And honestly, by the end of it, I finished the campaign. By the end of it, it made almost zero sense. And I felt like it kind of cut the legs out from Cortana, who's a major character in the series, that they more or less like not only sidelined, but like totally diminished any growth or change that she might have gone through in the last game, which I know that people really didn't like. But those are the areas. Now, if you're just looking at gameplay, I think it's a lot of, like, I had a fucking blast playing it, but it's just some weirdness with the campaign that does sort of hinder it. It gives me a tremendous amount of hope for the future of Halo, because I agree with you. Like, I think the grappling hook is now the equivalent of, like, Samus's ball power. Like, it's iconically attached to Master Chief and Halo now, because it feels so fucking good. But there are definitely some hindrances. I'm not saying that it, you know, it's going up against Monster Hunter Rise here.
Yeah.
Which has been incredible.
Is it worse than Monster Hunter Rise? No, I don't know. I don't know.
The narrative of Monster Hunter Rise is really...
I cried 100 times.
I agree with you there.
Before we get to that...
The novelization of this is one that I can't wait for.
Yeah, for Halo Infinite, though, all of your problems, Fresh, in the single player, all of the problems with Halo Infinite is that it's a Halo game. And in the multiplayer, everything good about it is that it's a Halo game. And yeah, the reason I say that with single player, all those tube levels you're talking about, go back and play any old Halo. Like, that is what, a third half of the levels in those games?
That is true.
Generic
you're
tubes.
Right. But I think it is starkly different from the rest of the game to the point where it was like if you took the Breath of the Wild mechanics in the open world, like Breath of the Wild just played like that in the open world, and then when you went into a dungeon, it played like Zelda 1.
That's my point. That's what I'm saying is Halo Infinite, when it's at its best, it is just a new game.
Right.
I mean, it's like a full reboot, right? And when it doesn't click is when it feels like it has to go back to being old school Halo with, you know, these like boring hallways where it's more emphasis on shooting versus all the weird powers that you have. And when it gets into the story, I mean, I'm talking about Fresh's text messages. He's had to listen to me talk about, you know, like probably 2 hours worth of YouTube videos that I've watched about Halo lore explainers to try to understand what the hell is happening. And let me tell you, it didn't make the game better. It definitely feels like it burned 2 hours.
It's like, so it's
even
it's
people who know the lore back to front do not understand what is going on in this game, which is like, I don't even know who the story is for at that point.
And I'm not willing to cede that, oh, it's a Halo game, so the plot's going to be bad, because Halo Reach was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think the first Halo game has a good
also,
story.
Halo 3, I'm not saying that as really an excuse, good. To be clear. That's not an excuse. I'm just saying it's a fact. Like, that's just a problem with Halo. But talking about the multiplayer, which I do think is separate, I think why it works is because it does feel like it gets back to everything that I felt when I played Halo 2 on LAN in a college dorm, right?
Yeah.
Like, it rules.
I would also, if I could say one thing, like, while the moment-to-moment narrative is pretty perplexing, the base conceit is that the war is over, we lost, Master Chief is the last, like, ember of resistance to this, like, this threat. And he is, like, building back up the forces of, like, the UNSC, like, by himself. And, like, rebuilding sort of the army to fight the bad guys. Like, that's classic. And that is a construct that I feel like is really smart for an open world Halo game.
I think it would work if we had any inkling of, like, really what happened in that downfall to have any attachment to these people.
The bad guys killed all the bad guys.
We don't even know.
No, it's the opposite. Do you know what my dream would be? Is that the war was lost. Flash forward 1,000 years. Nobody remembers anything. Random person discovers Master Chief, and then we've reset everything, and Master Chief is going to help us save
Amen.
The world. Which totally would actually fit into the Halo universe, because it turns out they've already done this. There was an entire, like, timeline before the modern timeline that was its own weird alien human.
I don't want to turn this into its own YouTube.
So, part one.
If I could just, before we move on to Monster Hunter Rise, I do want to point out one nitpick I have with Halo Infinite. It is wild when I am in a car and I'm driving with my soldier buddies and I may accidentally ding one of their friends with my car, right?
Sure.
Because it's hard to drive the cars and you'll ding people from
sometimes
time to time.
They jump out in front of you.
You just give them a little nudge. This happened to me and somebody in my car said, "Hey, watch out, dummy." And I stopped the car. I stopped the car and got out. And I said, "Excuse me, I'm the Master Chief.
Yeah.
You need to calm down a little bit, okay? You're welcome, by the way, because I definitely freed you because I have to because I freed everybody. You are welcome, by the way. You need to watch your tone with me, please. I'm going to ding some of your buddies. That's saving the galaxy." Anyway.
Monster Hunter Rise. I adore the Monster Hunter franchise. It didn't really super duper click with me until Monster Hunter World, which was the previous installment. That came out on consoles that kind of destroyed the mold that Monster Hunter games had followed in the past, which is there's a hub, you go out to a level, and you go through different loading zones to look for the monster, and then you get them and get their foot or whatever, and you turn that foot into a sword or crossbow, which is great. But we love that shit around here. Monster Hunter World smashed that apart and made it a much more sort of cohesive open world experience that improved the formula, I would argue, in every imaginable way. The only problem being I had to sit in my computer chair to play it.
Ugh, yeah.
And I hate that because that's where I do my work. Mm. Monster Hunter Rise came out on the Switch. I think it's actually just now coming out on PC, which is fantastic. Monster Hunter Rise takes so many lessons that world brought with it, that improved the formula, kind of mixes it in with some of the classic, like, Monster Hunter DNA stuff that wasn't, you know, that wasn't terrible, and combines it into maybe my favorite installment in the franchise, but more importantly, like, it turned it into a super, super, super compelling mobile game at a point that I feel like was a very, very necessary time in the world for that. And then now someone else is going to take over because I have...
Okay. I just wanted to say a thing about mobile games. I got that Analog Pocket finally came, right? I'm playing some classic Game Boy games. A little bit of that Metal Gear Solid, a little Mario Tennis. Mobile games, they've come a long way since Pac-Man. I don't know if you've really taken a moment to think about this lately, listener, but being able to play Metroid Dread and Monster Hunter Rise on a Switch, it's kind of mind-boggling that something this complex is just something that I can carry around with me. And I don't know. I feel like I kind of drift in and out of appreciating how incredible it is that just works. That's not like a huge praise for Monster Hunter Rise. Here's the thing about Monster Hunter Rise. I continue to just be heartbroken that I cannot get myself to fall in love with these games. Because I think I would like them. I don't know what it is.
Well, I know what it is. What? I mean, it is probably the hardest popular franchise to get into. And the fact that I needed to prime the pump by playing a few hours of Monster Hunter World to sort of understand the basics before I was able to watch a bunch of YouTube videos to learn the combos such that I could be good at Monster Hunter Rise. And at that point, it totally fully grabbed me and I was in love. But it still has not, even though people wanted World to be that thing, it still has not reached a point where it is accessible, at least at the outset. It's definitely not. I understand that people want depth. I want depth from the combat and the gameplay. But
the tutorial to this game is just not so rough. It's yeah. So it's such a grind.
It's really tough to get into. So I think that's still probably the biggest complaint that I have, as much as, you know, I sunk 100 hours into that fucking game this year. So I absolutely adore it. But I think there definitely is a version of Monster Hunter that exists or could exist that reworks a lot of the structural stuff while maintaining the gameplay stuff and still having it feel like Monster Hunter while allowing people that like don't dig into menus and like meta and shortcuts for their equipment loadouts and various other nitty gritty like that. I think there's a way to streamline this and it just hasn't happened yet. I love Monster Hunter Rise. Even though I was pretty harsh on Halo Infinite's storyline, Plant is right. The Monster Hunter Rise storyline barely exists. So it's hard not to consider them more or less equal on that front. And I think Halo Infinite is probably the more special game. I think there is a version of Monster Hunter Rise in a year or two that maybe elevates it to Game of the Year status, but it is not quite Halo Infinite's level at this moment.
So?
I mean, Halo Infinite for me.
Yeah, for sure.
Me too.
Okay.
We don't care about Griffin.
He doesn't get a vote. It doesn't matter. He's
getting a pizza.
Okay. Inscription, Forza Horizon 5. I'll take Forza if somebody can take Inscription.
You do Forza first, Plant.
Okay.
I'm going to talk a lot about Inscription, Russ, so it's probably good.
Yeah, I'll start and you could fill in.
Okay. So I don't think we're going to spend a ton of time on Forza because it's a hard game to talk about in this capacity, but the one thing I want to say is this team has been honing this game for a decade, and I think it's easy to underappreciate that. And when I say honing it, I mean this is a totally different game than where they started. Forza Horizon 1 like isn't really an open world game. Horizon 2 had these like weird barriers throughout the world that were like walled train tracks that really prevented you from feeling like you were in open space. Horizon 3 is this rough draft of a really Horizon 5. They have a lot in common. But then instead of doing the like Austin Powers to Austin Powers 2, let's just do the same thing all over again. Forza Horizon 4 is this weird experiment. Like they add seasons to the game and weather that has a huge impact on how and where you drive. They added all these silly cars. They got rid of the tropical setting and went to the UK, which I think was a choice. I don't like Forza Horizon 4 nearly as much as the other games, but a lot of those ideas have appeared in Horizon 5 so that 5 feels like the perfect mishmash of 3 and 4. And I feel like in the world of video games, if this were a action game or a shooter, like if this was Assassin's Creed or Call of Duty, everybody would be talking about this because it'd be like, wow, this team, they've worked so hard for the past decade and they finally did the thing. You know, all of these big ideas culminated into the, you know, Assassin's Creed 4 or Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, that sort of point in a franchise. And I think that is important. That said, do I think that is going to help it win the game of the year this year? No, but I do think it's some interesting history, so I've made my defense.
Hey. I think, for what it's worth, even though it might not make it to the top of like game of the year lists this year, or at least the very top, it is, I think when it came out, Halo has probably beaten it since, but when it came out, was like the most played Xbox game ever, like some outrageous stat. Because of Game Pass and a variety of other things. So even though it's not necessarily from a critical standpoint the most exciting game to talk about, it has an enormous audience and fan base, and count me among that. I said this last week. Haven't gotten into a racing game in years and years and years, and this one totally grabbed me and was a blast. It's really just terrific. a super fun game to play.
Did y'all put Monster Hunter Rise upon the altar while I was gone talking to
contractors? Yes, it was sacrificed while you were
That's
gone.
A shame. I had a really good time.
I mean,
time
you
with
were
that.
Outvoted regardless, but yeah. If you wanted to say something about
Rise,
and
this has always been
could.
A show about numerical voting,
yeah, that's fair.
If nothing else.
Okay.
Russ is about to give his impassioned description of Inscription.
Okay, Inscription. I think we probably described it a little bit last week, but a narrative card game with horror elements and weird secrets and puzzles, and a game that is very much a puzzle box insofar as it starts as one thing, in this case, like a Hearthstone-style card game, card battling game, and then sort of evolves into something that is a lot weirder and more interesting than that.
Like an escape room.
Yeah, it has escape room elements to it. It just has sort of like a secret to it. And again, I like hesitate to even know how much to say about Inscription, because I do think the shifts that it has are its best aspects, because it does make a constantly for a more interesting narrative experience. But I also have strong feelings about the latter half of the game as well. So it is extremely, extremely unique, probably the most unique game on this list, and one of the most interesting games I've played in the last few years, not without its faults, but also I think a game that most people should play at the very least.
I'm this is more color than an argument, but I was such a fan of this. I went back and played Pony Island, which I had not played. This is Pony Island's the first Daniel Mullins game, and I have not played the Hex yet. But Pony Island is interesting in the sense like it's a similar. It seems to be that meta game elements with like shifting mechanics is what really interests him as near as I can tell. And Pony Island is a game where you are playing a sort of like extremely basic platformer where you're a pony and you're like collecting, I don't know, you're shooting butterflies with, it doesn't matter. Like that is how inconsequential the main mechanical game of Pony Island is. And when the other narrative elements start to get layered on, which include like basically the devil trying to trap people's souls in a computer, it is like, it feels sort of flippant or like almost, I guess punk is maybe like the word I'm looking for. It's like, it razzes the main mechanic, like how stupid, I can't believe you ever cared about that. That's not what the game is. That's the joke, right? What I think is cool about Inscription is that even in when the mechanics shift and in the main mechanics and the meta mechanics, it all works together. Like it is all a cohesive thought. And like the way that you're playing with cards where characters are basically sort of what you come to realize are like sort of trapped in these cards is important to the meta narrative as much as it is important to the sort of like base mechanical thing. And as it shifts, that continues to work in concert with what came before and after. It's never sort of like, yeah, anyway, it's all just a goofy game, but what I'm really interested in is this. It is all of a piece. And I think that like to make the point, they just did a DLC thing where you can play the first segment of the game, which is this sort of like card battler, you know, not unlike Slay the Spire or what have you. And you can play that infinitely, like which you wouldn't do like if it was sort of a joke the way that Pony Island is. But I again, like I said, not an argument for or against, but just like I think interesting color.
I think we can just have a vote on this because I think Inscription is going to have more for us all to talk about in a later round.
I got much further in this game over the past week, I think, into Act 3, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how much more is coming after that.
You're near the end, yeah.
But I did not enjoy the core card game element of the game after Act 1. And I'm glad that I played through, especially past Act 2, because Act 3 gets pretty fucking buck wild. And I think that novelty of like what this game does and the sort of boldness of it absolutely earns it a spot on this list. But like I dreaded every sort of like forced battle that you have to do you know, from yeah. act two on. It Griffin, really
for you
loses.
Though. Does Forza win in this round?
Oh no.
Okay, so then yeah, let's
okay,
let's
that's fine.
Let's move forward and then. But yeah, I tend to agree with you, Griffin, and I think we'll talk about that in the back half.
Okay.
Okay. Next round. Last one of this. I went series
quarter.
Unsighted versus Resident Evil 8. I feel like I've been the unsighted person. Is there any, I'll talk about Resident Evil if somebody else can take unsighted.
I can take unsighted.
Okay, do you want to do that really quick? Because it sounds like with the general...
Yeah, I don't need to describe what unsighted is. We talked about it last week. I think it is an exciting evolution of a format that, you know, over the years can get a little samey. I think we talked about in the context of A Link Between Worlds, this sort of, which sort of reworked the Zelda format on the 3DS. This does it in a completely different way, but I think does it in a really special way that will definitely stick with me. I have not finished it yet, but I'm extremely far into it, and it's terrific. It's just a really incredible feat by a very small team that is worth playing. I still don't love block pushing puzzles, of which there are a number, but it's definitely a secondary point to the narrative strength of the game. The combat is really, really strong. I really like the art style. I think this game just does a ton right. And it definitely should be played by a lot of people.
Yeah, I love Unsighted. Any other game that would be going against it would probably be making it further for me. Unfortunately, it's going up against the Resident Evil game in which you fight Dracula, Pinocchio, The Little Mermaid, and Frankenstein. I don't know how anything honestly beats that. That to me is everything that I've wanted the Resident Evil series to do. Yeah.
You can't just lump Pinocchio in with the other things.
What do you mean?
They're all monsters.
It's not inherently a monster sort of
person. Yeah, Pinocchio is definitely a monster.
Have you seen Chucky? It's basically that.
Yeah, Pinocchio is a monster.
True. Okay.
Why do you think he gets sent to the Bad Boy Island?
And turned into a donkey.
Yeah, I guess he's a monster. There's empirical proof that he is a bad boy.
Yeah. So, well, actually, and I should be clear, Frankenstein's a monster, not Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Well, really, but the monster's also named Frankenstein, so it's fine.
Yeah, that's true. He names him
Frankenstein's monster, Frankenstein.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think Resident Evil 8's going to win this, and I think we're going to talk about it more later. Does that sound right?
That sounds right to me. It is the best Resident Evil game, apparently.
Yeah. I would agree. I would probably vote it over Unsighted, yes.
That said, Unsighted is great, and I know a lot of people have not played it. It is on Game Pass. People should really give it a try because
it runs great on Switch too.
Oh yeah, it does.
It's a real good fit there.
A little bit later in the game, it gets a little spotty now and then when things get busy, but it's still quite good.
That's it for the semifinals, right? We got or quarterfinals. We got Metroid Dread, Halo Infinite, Inscription, and Resident Evil Village. Are we going to make them all pair off again, or are we just going to do one big...
We're going to do versus.
One big melee. Okay.
So yeah, next up, we will have Metroid Dread versus Halo Infinite and Inscription versus Resident Evil 8 right after this break.
I feel like this is where it's going to get competitive. It's going to get nasty.
I feel like this is going to be super easy. I feel like these two rounds, like I could tell you right now, Metroid Dread and Resident Evil 8... should face off.
Yeah, see, I don't... That's interesting.
Ooh, okay, this is why we do it the way we do it.
This is why we do it.
I don't know it's going to be that cut and dry, pal.
We'll see.
Let's start with Metroid Dread versus Halo Infinite. Is there anything more that needs to be said about either of these games in a vacuum?
Well, I think it...
Yeah, I could say that. There's no reality in which Metroid Dread is better than Halo Infinite.
Okay, so that's Halo just Infinite opinion.
Is a mat. Well, yeah, but this is all opinion, so I'm stating it as fact. Halo Infinite, like, and you know, you always struggle with this, right? Because you're really kind of talking about two games, but it is two games in one package. And I think that, like, the campaign, if it was just the campaign, I would probably lean towards Metroid Dread, but I have had I think the Halo Infinite multiplayer is such a victory and like such a massive leap forward and like a revitalization of a franchise that has languished for, I mean, over a decade, I would argue, like creatively, if not commercially. I think it is such a smart reinvention of it and something that people will be playing for a very, very long time for reasons that I have detailed extensively. But I love it, and I think that it is such a triumph.
I agree with Justin. I am shocked that anybody else would be on the Halo side, but I do want to note that Halo Infinite dares to ask the question, when Scorpion says, get over here, what if he said, get over there?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
The grappling hook, we have talked about in an open world, like, getting around sense, but you cannot discount, it is the biggest, like, mechanical evolution. Like, I can't think of a good comparison. You know, you talked about the ball, and, like, it is almost kind of like that in the sense that this is such a, the game is so much about positioning and, like, where you are at in relation to the enemies, and having the ability to, like, instantly reposition yourself in a way that's more advantageous, there it makes every death feel fair, because it's like, well, you're right, I should have fucking moved. I don't know why I didn't. I could have grapple hooked away from that, but I just kind of like gritted my teeth and tried to go through with it.
I can't think of another franchise that has an addition like this that so fundamentally changes the entire franchise.
I think Breath of the Wild.
Yeah. Oh,
I can think of a lot.
Okay, yeah, done. Oh, yeah. Me,
fair.
Dumb.
but okay, I mean, really what this boils down to is this: Halo Infinite obviously has a lot of great things. It has some not great things. Whereas I think Metroid Dread is basically baller from start to finish. And now I'm not saying that is a reason to make the choice, but it is, there is a consideration to be made about, like, do you include everything, and some of it might work and some of it might not work, versus do you just focus on the stuff that you know you can crush out of the park?
I'm staunchly in Metroid Dread's corner in this battle, but I also think, like, there are things that people did not like about Metroid Dread. And the biggest one I can think of is, like, it was pretty easy to get lost in that big map, which for a lot of people playing a Metroidvania game, like, that's a tough wall to scale and can sometimes sort of bring the whole thing to a stop. I got lost a couple times, but for me, it was never so bad that I felt like, well, screw this game, I quit forever.
But do you also feel, you know, I think without that element, that potential to get lost, don't you feel like it kind of feels like you're being dragged by the nose? You know, we talked about this in Deathloop, like dragged by the nose to like point to point.
Yeah, I think Metroid Dread hits a point where the thing opens up a lot more than, like, really any Metroidvania that I have played before, right?
Hollow Knight is probably comparable, I would say.
Yeah, I would say so. Because a typical Metroidvania game, like, you go, you beat the boss, you get the check, you get the double jump, you get the grappling hook, you get whatever you need to get through the few locked doors to get to the next section, to get to the next boss, to get to the next power-up. Metroid Dread, you know, does that, but I think it disguises it better than most games in that genre, to where, like, I felt like my path through the game was different from other people's. Like, I, you know, you can potentially find your way into, like, a teleportal that you know, maybe somebody else playing the game did not find, and it let you access, like, a whole world of things that otherwise you would not be able to find, which was really, really exciting to me.
Yeah. I think the peaks of Metroid Dread are higher for me than the peaks of Halo Infinite.
I feel that way too. I also think, like, this is a tough thing because I didn't care for the campaign of Halo Infinite, but I thought the multiplayer was really fun, although I never really felt like I got pretty good at it. So it's like also a question of what's better, like a really, really solid single player campaign versus like a really, really fun multiplayer sandbox. And that's like, you know, apples and oranges.
With a really solid single-player campaign, too. I mean, it definitely has its missteps, but, like, we can't just be like, well, and the campaign is whatever, but the multiplayer, because the campaign of Halo is really cool. I mean, there's, like, all the, we just spent a lot of time talking about like how the open world has all this interesting stuff and how it makes all the weapons more relevant and the tactics and all that stuff. Like I you can't discount that.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a campaign to me, though. I don't know if this is even a knock, but it feels more like I have fun playing in the Halo sandbox, but the thing moving me through that, like the story or whatever it is, moving me through that sandbox, I do not find personally compelling.
You're saying that you need some like bird people.
Yeah, the great narrative of Metroid Dread that we all know and like adore so much.
I think it's a good story.
I mean, I think there's also a pretty good narrative.
It's not an amazing story, but it's good.
Metroid Dread is also like there's like it. I said it was accessible in a previous episode to people who like hadn't played the franchise from a narrative perspective, but like it could do a lot better at like onboarding people. I mean, I think if you look at, you know, we had, I don't want to turn this into a debate about accessibility, but like we definitely talked about Metroid Dread sort of like you have to meet it on its terms, and it is not doing a lot to sort of like make sure everybody has fun playing Metroid Dread. And I think that you would be very well within your rights to get frustrated by some of like the ways it expects you to like attack hidden walls to move forward on the critical path, or you know, the way that you can get kind of lost and have to move around the world before you're kind of figuring out the next thing you need to do. It's not like it's this seamless, you know, thing that just like carries you from the beginning to end. Like there's some real roadblocks that I think could turn some people
huge
off.
Huge thanks to our special guest contributor David Jaffe on today's episode. Just wanted to say,
listen,
I think
me
you
and
do
Dave,
great work.
thank you Griffin for picking up my hilarious David Jaffe reference. But yeah, I mean, that's obviously like I'm not on I have not been on Team Jaffe for quite some time.
Sure.
But like I think it's an illustration of the point, like that I think that it's fair to think you could get turned off by some of the difficulties.
I think Halo feels like a step one where a year from now or whatever it is, Halo Infinite is going to be like the game that is just like totally dominant on every front. But it does continue to feel for me like it is very much a work in progress, which honestly they haven't denied.
The multiplayer is in no way accurate. Like
the multiplayer is in beta. Is like they've been pretty open about that, and it definitely has some issues.
But it's like incredible now. Like it's incredible now. It's fantastic. The progression is kind of a mess, but like they will fix that stuff. But the core mechanics are unbeatable.
I think we should have a vote. I don't have a whole lot of religion here. I do lean towards Halo Infinite, but
I mean it's I'm for Metroid Dread. I think Russ is also. Justin's
yeah,
for
I'm,
Halo
I
Infinite.
I am too. Even though I like both of these, you know, it feels to me like Halo is well on its way to being the game, but I don't think it's quite there yet.
I did not feel particularly compelled to keep playing the campaign of Halo Infinite. Like I got into the open world stuff and was doing some of that and just didn't feel like this is a thing I want to put more time.
I'm very frustrated by the fact that we all finished Metroid Dread, and it feels like that I am now having like this debate with people that have not. I'll tell you where I'm uncomfortable is that like I really liked Metroid Dread, and I can't sit here and make argument, like I've made the best argument I can against it, but I don't have a lot of arguments against it. I think it's great. Like I just feel like Halo Infinite is going to like is a sort of, we have not had a great like multiplayer game in this style for a while, and I feel like it is so smart and so powerful in the way that it like reinvigorates this franchise and makes it relevant again, that I think is really worth celebrating. And it's so fun. I mean, I handed the controller to Griffin when we were in Seattle, and he instantly was like, got it. Like the multiplayer was just like fun already, mid-match, hand the controller to somebody. It's just great.
Do you feel comfortable voting on Griffin's behalf?
What's that?
I was just wondering if Justin felt comfortable voting on your behalf since he handed you the controller.
I'm sure he would.
I'm going to throw a little bit of a wrench in the works, and I don't know if this is a negative or a positive.
Oh, no.
My understanding is that Halo Infinite multiplayer specifically builds very much on the positive response to the multiplayer in Halo 5. Even though the campaign was universally hated, people really, really liked the campaign in Halo 5. And
the multiplayer.
This takes a lot from that. Again, not a bad thing, but
Metroid Dread doesn't build off of anything.
Okay.
No, Russ makes a great point that the problem with Halo Infinite is that they took the good lessons from the last Halo game and retained them. Start again, cowards. Make him a wizard.
The history of video games has no precedent for such a thing.
Why do you decide to do a podcast with an even number of people is the question.
I know, right? It's our curse. We need to get the Chris Grant.
Oh my gosh. Metroid Dread wins because I don't want the logjam, and I'm okay with both of these games. I think
let me just text Chris and see where he's at.
No, there are two people here who I think are very passionate about a choice, and then there's one who's very passionate about the other. So
you know what? I will let it go just because I feel like I am happy with Metroid Dread, and I hope I was shocked by how much I enjoyed Metroid Dread and how smart it is. Like it, I really adore it. So I am okay with that. And I will. So we can move forward.
Okay.
Inspiring.
Well, what an inspiring sacrifice, Justin.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like I did.
And I also want to keep a little in the tank.
Yeah.
I didn't get that hero moment when y'all killed Monster Hunter Rise when I was talking about my toilet to a contact. Inscription versus Resident Evil Village. This is gonna be another spicy one, I feel like.
Okay, so we kind of skipped over the Inscription part of it.
Okay.
Last round. So I'll be more pointed.
So we're not gonna talk about specific story beats, but we will be talking about the quality of the overall game.
And we can talk about acts. If you've played the game and we say Act 3 or Act 2, you're gonna know what we're talking about. There's a reason why they just released DLC where you can replay Act 1 over and over and over again. Is because as a game, it is by far the most fun part of Inscription, in my opinion.
Yes.
I don't know if y'all feel differently, but I do think as a game, the game gets less fun in Act 2, gets a little more fun in Act 3. But the narrative sort of carries it, which I was really like very interested to see where the narrative was going. And that I think helped buoy, moments of the game that I thought were like a little bit, even although they were creative, like Act Two, not the most fun game to play.
Right. I feel like I can talk about this without spoilers. In Act One, you are playing a very clever and unique, TCG, against a genuinely unsettling opponent who, like, I wanted to know everything about, and then also who I wanted to beat the living shit out of. And so
And who also didn't seem interested in playing, like, who was obviously in control of everything.
Yes.
To a point where it made, like, any victory you could eke out, like, an
totally
anomaly.
Futile.
It felt like you pulled one over.
And it takes place in a minuscule environment that is filled with like mysteries and puzzles that you want to figure out, if only so you can get a slight leg up on this monster, right? And the card game is great. I thought the card game was very, very smart. You basically have to sacrifice your cards in order to play other cards and build walls to, you know, block attacks from your opponent. And the game can end like in a second. Because you have one bad turn, the enemy hits you with 5 points of damage, you're dead. So the matches are very, very fast. You can also get a one-turn KO, and it feels very, very good when you can manage to swing that. But that is the main like mechanic of the card game. There's special little rules for certain cards, which is very Hearthstone-y. But you can grok it all really fast. And then in Act 2, I'm not going to get into like the narrative of what happens, but it then layers basically three more sort of card games on top of that, like three different card games worth of rules on top of that. And while those rules are similarly not that hard to master, it makes all of the work that I did in Act One of like figuring out like how to be good at this game feel like totally, not totally, but almost entirely pointless.
Yeah, also it feels like they want you to try those other card decks, but I just got one at the beginning and then just swept through the entire
section. That's all I cared about. To put a pin in it, then Act 3 comes and does the exact same thing. And like it it's
Act 3 is more successful than
Act 3 is more successful mechanically, but again, it's like wipe it all out. You're playing a new card game now. And like on paper, that's pretty cool. Because, you know, it's like the narrative of the game and the world of the game, it's always changing. And so like, it makes sense that that should happen. But when you're playing it and you are getting that feeling from the, you know, trading card game loop of I am figuring this motherfucker out. And then to have that taken from you, not once, but twice, like it is so defeating. And I think that maybe just speaks to the strength of Inscription's like narrative and like cleverness, that is enough to make me keep playing it, even when the mechanics of the game are, I feel like, fighting against me.
Unfortunately, then the ending happens, and then the narrative is.
I like the ending.
Oh, I like the ending too.
Resident Evil Village.
Yeah, go for it, Plant.
Me?
Sure.
I kind of did it last time. I mean, it's the best Resident Evil game. I mean, the main character is a stick of butter, like taking a bath in a glass of milk, and I love him, and I want to.
The characters in this game, like in a game where it much of its legacy is defined by, I'm sorry, but like how laughably bad the like writing and performances and just characters in general are. I'm sorry, Resident Evil devotees, but like there's a lot of cruft in there. I think that this game comes with like a big cast of really cool, like interesting, fun, well-performed, well-written characters, which like really helps to propel to say nothing of like the hub structure, which feels great. Yeah. Like it feels so cool for a survival horror game to have that like relative safe space that is then like also degraded and dangerous in different ways. Like I think that it really is like recently the actress who played Lady D, the giant woman, won for best performance at the Game Awards. And it's like, that's where Resident Evil Village is at, like compared to performances and writing that were so bad that became mimetic.
I would love to see I would love to see Nemesis get up there to receive his game award. Like, thanks everybody. I really shouted stars a lot and people loved that, and I did a good job yelling.
Hell
thanks,
yeah.
Couldn't have done
that's
it
pretty good, Griffin.
Stars.
It is
Maggie Robertson, by the way. I wanted to credit Maggie for her fantastic work. So
it is not. Maggie Robertson. It's definitely worth paying attention to the fact that, like, although towards the end they start like getting into like a little bit more lorey stuff, just like a little sprinkling of it. 95% of the game is, you know, pretty cogent. I mean, it's silly, but it's a pretty cogent storyline. Like, I get what's going on.
The only lore, though, that I feel like is necessary to understand for 8 is 7, which, great news, 7 is the other fantastic Resident Evil.
Griffin, guess what? I didn't play 7, and I followed 99% of that game.
Oh, okay.
That's great.
Yeah, I think it adds.
I think they designed it to be approachable.
Also, this is how I wish games like Halo Infinite operated with their lore, which is get you fully invested in its own discrete story. And then by the time they do stop dropping, you know, little pieces of the larger lore across the universe, you actually want to know what's happening, right? Like, you feel like, well, I'm already, you know, pot committed.
Yeah, you need to start
small. I really
care.
Yeah.
So when did this game come out? January? Like February?
February, I think, yeah.
It's so funny because the more we talk about it, literally right now in this moment, the more hyped I'm getting. Because
it's
that
so
game,
good.
The tone of Resident Evil Village, the like relentless, almost like B-movie, like, level horror that it delivered, that tone abso-fucking-lutely did it for me. Like, the Pinocchio and Frankenstein and Dracula and all that, that is completely accurate. Because that game, it does not take itself seriously really at all until maybe the last, like, you know, fifth of the story or whatever.
Well,
and the rest of the time, it's just, like, a nonstop, like, really schlocky but really well made story that I could not put down.
Yeah, but our friends at Into the Aether, the wonderful video game podcast, have been talking about camp lately in relation to like Halo Infinite and how Halo Infinite at its best feels campy, but it doesn't manage to like stick to it. Resident Evil Village to me, is like the definition of good campy video game, where it is all silly, but everyone involved with it, it's taking the creation of it very seriously. All the performances are like earnest performances. The writing is intended to be good writing. It just happens to also be quite silly because you are a human god who's trying to collect the body parts of someone you love. Like,
yeah,
mm-hmm. You know, it's what you're doing is inherently weird, but the way it propels forward is like told as if it were any other story.
And it does, as campy and silly as it is, it also got some pretty good scares out of me. It got we can talk a lot about the
baby.
You can talk a lot about like Lady Dimitrescu and like how memed she got. But then when she starts like turn a corner and see her with her big ass claws, like 9 feet taller than you are, that'll tighten up the old butt cheeks.
Y'all, I'm starting to get the sense that Resident Evil might win this. If that's the case, we might want to have a vote. That way we have some stuff to chat about in the final round.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Honestly, guys, I Inscription is my favorite game of the year, but the complaints about the mechanics, especially in the second act, are like very legitimate. I let the fact that I loved everything it was doing to sort of like color that, but I very much was like, it went from loving the mechanics to sort of like powering through to see what the story was going to do next. And I think that's a completely legitimate
I would
point.
Play, obviously, like the change in world and all the stuff that Inscription does, like that's the magic trick. Like that's the reason why it is like, I think, getting a lot of goatee heat right now. But also to rival that, I would play like a full length act one of Inscription.
Yeah.
Cause I thought that was so fucking cool and great and scary and unsettling and smart. And I, you know, some of those adjectives would go on to describe the other acts, but
I think you will see way more narrative driven card experiences in a couple years inspired by this.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised.
I agree. Yeah, I think Inscription rules also. I've soured on the story at the conclusion quite a bit. And this is just a thing for indie games. I really wish indie games, if they're going to have live action video, cast people that I assume are not your friends. Because I know I said it before. I can't get over the idea of there's like such a pivotal role in this game. And the actress is extremely talented, but it makes no sense. It's like I don't understand why this company hired somebody in their 20s. And it like really breaks the game for me in a truly bizarre way.
It is funny because I completely agree with you. I also find it like weirdly charming in the like
it is
film school kind of way. But it does seem also, I mean, that's a part of the reason that I found the end entertaining is because it was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I get it.
Thanks to Steven Spawn for like introducing this show to the best. Like that was literally my first exposure. He's like, I've been playing this neat thing, and I instantly like got into it and bullied everybody else into getting into it too.
All right, Resident Evil, what a wild showdown this last thing is.
I was not necessarily expecting this.
Nor I. Metroid Dread versus Resident Evil Village.
Yeah, I was really hoping that Halo would have pulled up. Sorry. Okay, let's do it.
You were hoping what?
Halo is going to pull it out.
I mean, do you want to go...
No.
Just
no.
So Resident Evil could trounce
I'm
it?
I'm just messing with you, Justin. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I should.
Here's what I always suggest. Let's take a pause before we finish the head to head because we just talked about these two games in depth. Let's give a little breathing room and just talk about the rest of the year. Some other stuff that like popped for everybody. I could start real quickly because I mentioned Kingdom Two Crowns that I've been like absolutely obsessed with. And it's timely because just this month they released Norselands, which is a complete, it's really cool what they're doing with it. There's several of these, by the way, where it's like the game has been completely reskinned with like a different, this is obviously takes it to like a Norse setting. So your little dudes that you're recruiting, the structures that you're building, it all looks completely different. And there are some like interesting little mechanical changes, which are small enough that people who weren't, you know, deep into the game probably wouldn't appreciate. So it's not really worth detailing here. But I just finished the main thing and like instantly went and started a Norselands campaign. And it's like mechanically not that different, but the core mechanics are so good in Kingdom Two Crowns. I'd really love for you guys to try it. Not for any Game of the Rear reason, just because like I think it's really genius. But that, and it's like a $3 upgrade, I think, for the Norselands content. And it's just like a really cool way of like breathing new life into something that I wanted to keep playing, but in like a new setting and new things to discover. And it's beautiful to look at, and in a way that's like similar to, but not exactly like, kind of like a Super Brothers kind of vibe. Sure. That sort of like beautiful, slightly gothic, retro look. I just think I love it. If you were looking for something to play on most platforms, I think at this point, it's well worth checking
out. Can I just say, in that same context, I love to see these smaller games from indie studios just getting this like long-term support to the point of like, hey, if something works and maybe the audience is not like tens of millions of people, but the audience is pretty big, we're just going to keep giving you updates over time. And some of them are paid and some of them are free. You look at a game like Dead Cells, which has a new expansion coming out, or I think it's coming out in January.
I think it might be out. Oh, okay.
Or it might be out.
Stardew Valley too, which just had a...
Yeah, or Stardew Valley, or like so many of these games are sort of building on this model of, oh, we made this popular game, we're going to keep it at the top of the sales charts because we're constantly going to be giving you reasons to boot it up again. And it's awesome. I'm like so charmed by it, which is sort of a good segue because I don't think I've played any game other than Binding of Isaac this year. Same. And, you know, we've talked about it a lot in recent weeks as Griffin has sort of gotten into it. But talk about a series that has been doing that for 10 years at this point. Of updates and just like layering in ways to sort of scale up the original format. And this just...
Repentance is $20, but also well worth the amount of content you get for that is outrageous.
To give you an idea. So in the original game, or at least the last update before Repentance came out, there were 15 playable characters. This is a little bit of a spoiler, but I think it's worth knowing. Repentance adds 15 more playable characters. They're all like very creative twists on the original characters, but giving you an entire hundreds of hours of reasons to go through and replay these levels with new characters, in addition to adding new chapters and stuff like that. And that, I think, will continue to be the future of gaming, where we have this successful thing or this popular thing, and we just sort of cultivate it like a seed. Yeah. And it just grows out from there and lives way longer. You know, Binding of Isaac, when it first came out, was a flash game that we thought was going to be whatever. You play for a month and that's it. And now we're 10 years later. That's incredible and so exciting. So, yeah, fucking
I'm sharing a game that I haven't played. Cool. I don't know if any of us have played it. Have any of you played Before Your Eyes?
Haven't even heard of it.
So this is our big miss of the year, and I apologize to everybody who is hoping for us to talk about it. We will talk about it next year, I'm sure. Before Your Eyes is a game that you control with your eyeballs. It uses eye tracking to control the game, and when you blink, it effectively, like what I understand, ends a scene and moves on to another scene or serves as some sort of input. Again, I haven't played it. This is the game that I saw making a real last-minute run on a lot of Game of Year lists from people I respect, like Jacob Geller. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to playing it. I wish I had more to say about it.
This looks cool.
Yeah, right?
Real cool.
I mean, this is the cool thing about video games, right? Like, there will always be a game like this every year for us that we miss just because there is so much out there. Like that rules, especially since January is usually pretty slow. So I look forward to having something new to play over the holiday.
I would argue another one we missed, which has shown up on virtually every other Game of the Year list, is Chicory.
That game
rules. Yeah, that one kind of slipped between the cracks. I feel like it's one we would have gotten.
I started playing it on PC and didn't really get it, I feel like. But then it literally just came out on Switch last week in like one of those indie world surprise drops. And it's really good and really well written and has a lot of really cool stuff to say about imposter syndrome, which I think is a thing that is relatable to pretty much all internet content creators. I was looking for something more than just like, oh, you run around the world and you can paint stuff if you want to. But now I love running around the world and painting stuff. Like, I will take time to like color in a person's house just to make it, you know, for no reason, unless there was some sort of side quest associated with it. It's just a little and special game. The one that I can't believe like I didn't bring to this list is Hitman 3, which I adored. Like, I talked about how excited I was to finally like get into this franchise that I'd always wanted to get into and how successful Hitman 3 was in virtually every way. There's probably some things now that were on my top five that I submitted for our Game of the Year approval that, thinking back, I probably enjoyed Hitman 3 a bit more than that. I don't know if it resonated with anybody else too. I don't think it would make it very far in these considerations, but Hitman 3 fucking rules.
Yeah, it was on my top five list. And I completely agree with you. It's fabulous. You know, I think I talked about it in the context of Deathloop last episode, specifically the idea of like where Deathloop can be very locked down and limiting in terms of how you do things. Hitman 3, super duper not.
Yeah.
I was just like really amazed by how much creativity, how much freedom you're granted in that game. It's really quite spectacular and also has seen like a number of content updates since launch, which is also really exciting. Hitman 3 rocked. One of my favorite games of the year.
All right. We've put this off enough, I think.
Okay.
Metroid Dread versus Resident Evil Village.
Should we just do a heads up vote right now just to see which way the wind's blowing?
Let's do that. Just so, because we're curious.
I said that, and I don't actually know which one of these I want to vote for.
Okay, take a second. I'm going to count to three, and then everybody's going to say the name of the best game of the year.
Okay.
Okay. And not Inscription, which obviously is the best game of the year, but is no longer in contention. One, two,
Metroid. Resident Evil Village.
Yeah,
see, this is going to be a show. We have to do more show now.
Now there's more show. Man,
I'm going to say this. Part of this is I still feel pretty strongly that, and maybe this isn't fair, Resident Evil 4 is the best Resident Evil game ever made.
False.
And that I've only been more confident of that as I play the VR version, which is spectacular. I really, really loved Resident Evil Village.
That's a shame because Metroid Dread can't win now because there have been other good Metroidvanias.
Yeah, that's just true. Saying. That's a huge knock against Metroid. Yeah. And you know what? They used a lot of the stuff from the last Metroid game that was good when they were making Metroid Dread.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Village.
Come on, guys.
Let me knock down Village a little bit.
Yeah, fuck it up, Russ.
I think two of the environments in Village, and there are not that many, maybe three, if you count the actual village itself, are like, eh. I think the castle is spectacular. I think the haunted doll cabin, spectacular. I have no enthusiasm for like walking through a cruddy dock or a broken down village or a factory full of Frankensteins.
Yeah. On the flip side, though, it's really cool to run through rock tunnels for fucking 12 hours. And sometimes they're covered in metal. I mean, we all love exploring the rich tapestry of the caves and metal rooms of Metroid.
Not fair. Metroid Dread has a lot of biodiversity.
There's a hot place and a cold place.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
I love that.
How about like the like ancient civilization that has been locked down that you wander into and accidentally do a very unfortunate thing that then changes the rest of the environments for the rest of the game? Like, I don't think that's a complaint you can leverage against Metroid Dread. I think Metroid Dread's world feels like extremely alive. I disagree with Russ entirely also about his criticisms for Resident Evil Village, because it's each one of those is like its own little horror movie, and I think that the environments work perfectly for what, you know, tone they're going for.
I kind of wish it was more colorful, quite honestly. Like, they took a little bit more
went like even harder on it. Yeah, sure.
Oh man, Resident Evil Village is good though.
It's really good.
Remember when you have to find the sad fish person and they're just so sad, and then you know that it's not going to go well for them.
By far my least favorite part of the entire.
Blow them up.
Remember how gonzo it is that there's like you're like finding baby parts in jars, guys? You know how one of the major AAA releases of the year is about finding baby parts in jars? You remember that? It's a wild thing. It's wild. It's so well written. It's so well performed. Narratively, the story lands so much more than Resident Evil, Heart of the Metroid, which, like, I'm sorry, is not about anything. Like, there's not even, like, a theme or a narrative point that it's making. I'm not saying that every game has to be, like, about something, but, like, Resident Evil is saying interesting things about family and the nature of family.
I think so.
Yes. What are you of course.
That didn't hit me very hard, but let me just say, Metroid Dread kind of is the culmination of all of the Metroid games so far, like all the mainline Metroid games so far. You can laugh. I mean, it is. It touches.
You're right. I'm sorry. To say
video that Metroid Dread doesn't have a story is like patently false. I feel like
it's not that it doesn't. I am making the point that, like, okay, here's what I'm saying. That stories, the way that I'm using the term, stories tell you something about, like, the world or the human condition or something. They have a point of view that is expressing the author's perspective on something. I'm saying that, like, you will finish Metroid Dread and not at any point question anything about anything. And then you can finish Resident Evil and, like, have, like, actual thoughts, or maybe – I'm not saying it's, like, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius or something, but, like, it does have, like, thematic elements that are about something. And I think that that is laudable and makes the time that you spend with it, like, more meaningful, because it's not just about, you know, the mechanics. There's more going on behind
the scenes. For what it's worth, Metroid Dread does have thematic elements about legacy and family and the idea of, like, conquering your past. And, like, if you really want to, like, go down that road, I think it's more pointed in Resident Evil Village. Like, it's more obvious. But because, you know, Samus says, like, three lines in the total of Metroid Dread. But it's definitely there.
Especially, I think for Metroid, the thing that separates it is you don't need to have played the past Resident Evil games in order to feel that, to play Resident Evil Village. I think in order to get that from Metroid Dread, you have to know, like, the history of the X-Parasite and the origins of her Chozo suit powers and, like,
that probably helps.
That stuff.
In either case, I don't think the story is like Metroid Dread is not a narrative game, right? Yeah, like, read a book.
But this isn't.
Thank you, Chris. That's a good point. Let's all remind ourselves that video game stories are all trash compared to literally the worst book you could imagine. The worst book has a better story than the best video game. I think we can all agree.
This is not. I'm not saying that it's a failing of Metroid Dread, right? But it is, like, if Halo was still in this, we would have to bring the multiplayer component of Halo into it, and that wouldn't be something that Metroid Dread is trying to do. We're just talking about why things are more or less successful.
I think that's
and fair. I liked especially as a parent, like, I like games that are talking about
what it means to be a parent. As a parent.
Metaphorically, yes. About how you can't protect your kids from the world and how you would do anything to try to do that, and in the end you can't. Like, I think that it's a very powerful beat, especially for a game where the, like, big narrative arc previously has been about, like, fuck, that guy's so big and he can walk through any wall and I hate it. Like, I think that that's a big victory.
The multiplayer mode for Village hasn't come out yet, right? The reverse thing?
I don't think so.
That's a separate game, isn't it?
That's a separate thing.
No, yeah. I think it's
I played I Mercenaries, but that's not multiplayer.
Yeah.
I would agree that the narrative elements in Resident Evil Village are more obvious. I don't think that's where Dread's strong suit lies. I think Dread, just from, like, a game feel perspective, from a boss design perspective, Metroid Dread has some of my favorite boss designs I've ever seen in a game. That, like, fucking Flappy Bird shit in the middle of a fight.
That was like, really good.
Yeah, that's cool.
It hits really peaks cool. on those boss designs that are spectacular. The cutscenes, like, after you finish a boss fight are universally fucking badass of Samus, like, showing... Like, Samus doing stuff that, like, I really wish Halo would absorb more, which is you don't need to show that much to really emphasize how cool this character is.
Right.
And I think Halo struggles with that sometimes, where it's just like, well, we're just going to have Master Chief say, I'm going to finish the fight, and that's it. And you could say less and still leave an impact.
I love both these games. The thing that keeps me coming back to Metroid Dread, and Russ just made me think of it, is like, anytime you take down one of these fucking Emmy bots that chase you around, and especially when you fit, like, for me, beating the final boss in Metroid Dread, which took me maybe 20 tries, gave me a sense of, like, exhilaration that, like, you know, a really good Souls game can do when you beat a really well-designed boss in one of those, that Metroid Evil, or Resident Evil Village didn't, like, necessarily do. I didn't find that game particularly, like, challenging, which takes a lot of the sort of scares out of it.
It feels like a more of a movie and less of a game to me, Resident Evil Village. It felt like beating it was an inevitability. Whether that's a good or a bad thing is sort of up to you and what you're looking for from games.
No, that, that makes sense.
We've moved beyond good and bad. Yeah, I think at this point it's about, like, what is landing for you.
Yeah, I mean, I feel right? Like, I like...
You don't have to... It doesn't have to be a negative or positive. It's just sort of, you know, why
I
it's
like
working.
The feel of conquering something that I know is fair but still difficult, which I think Metroid Dread is that. Resident Evil Village, I mean, you could jack up the difficulty all the way if you want, but it's not like a... necessarily super balanced experience.
Well, and the mechanics can't support that, right? It's not like it's like Halo is a good example of, like, you know it's kind of it feels different, but it's still a very satisfying thing because it's okay for you to scale that difficulty, and they've thought about that. I don't think that Resident Evil has that kind of.
But that is also not a great thing, like, in terms of accessibility, right? Because you can pick up Resident Evil Village and potentially tune it to the place where you can experience all that this game does have to offer you. And it has a lot to offer, whereas that is not a possibility for Metroid Dread, which I would say a pretty big mark against it.
So real quick, I'm going to go through our previous GOTY winners, if that's okay with you. And then we can see how how these two feel coming after that list. Does that work?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is off the best you've subreddit they haven't written down, so I hope it's all right. 2012, our first one, we gave it to Dishonored.
Feel good about that.
Good game.
2013, good game. We gave it to The Legend of Zelda: A Link Between Worlds.
Very Metroid Dread-esque, I would say.
Yeah. 2014, we give it to Dark Souls 2, and there's a parenthetical here. New York Giraffe put in the tiebreaker vote over Hearthstone.
We can't do that. What a weird year.
Yeah, it gets weirder. 2015, an inconclusive tie between Bloodborne, Rocket League, and Undertale.
What a
bunch of shitheads.
Although, you know what? If I were to sit here right now, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, not Undertale, obviously, or Rocket League. I guess I do.
2016, Stardew Valley, which, that sounds great.
Easy.
Oh, God, let's not.
2017, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Yeah. Great.
Yep.
2018, 100%. Return of the Obra Dinn.
Yes.
Choice.
God, fuck, that's a good video game. Yep. Let's make that the 2021 game of the year. Hey, come on, bud. Let's have another game,
bud.
Come on. Come on, bud.
2019, Sekiro, Shadows Die Twice.
Beating out Outer Wilds, tough. I'm sorry, Outer Wilds.
The right choice, Outer Wilds.
Outer Wilds. Anyway.
2020.
I did that. Do you know I did that to somebody? I met someone in Seattle who was on the who worked at Obsidian, and I fully was like, "Yeah, man, I love the Outer Oops. Wilds." They're like, "Well, that's not ours."
2020 was Hades.
Yeah.
Okay, so knowing all of that, it seems pretty obvious. Resident Evil Village. Great, we've done it.
Okay. I can't. I really want to cross. I love both of these games.
I know it's. Resident Evil is like edging it out because I love a lot of the
the stuff that it's do. I think the world is so cool. And beyond the theme, like the characters that you meet, like the Duke is like one of the, like to take again, like the merchant who has been kind of a joke in previous games, to make them like not only like sort of more mysterious, but also plot like relevant. Plot right. relevant in a way that actually feels like, I loved when that bit lands, like I thought was so cool and like I really uncharacteristic for a Resident Evil game, like the way the narrative kind of like evolves and surprises you constantly. Like I really, really loved that. I just thought that the narrative of Resident Evil like clicked with me so hard. And you know,
I'll do it. I'll switch.
Yeah.
I think I love both of these games, and when I think about them both, it's like two old-ass franchises that are moving in the best imaginable direction, I feel like.
Great year for that. Halo 2, yeah, right? Sure. Like, really good year for that.
And I think Metroid Dread is an exceptional game that does everything it does really well and challenges me in a way that I found, like, really, really cool, but also... is a reason why lots of other people could not get into it. I think Resident Evil Village succeeds in pretty much every like direction it tries to go, and is like a much more sort of accessible experience, that accessible not only in the sort of mechanical way, but also in the narrative way. Like, I think you could pick this game up and play it, and if you like any horror movie at all, like have a real ball with it. And also, I think it would be pretty novel for us to give Resident Evil Village the Game of the Year nod. Because I'm not seeing a lot of people like remembering how fucking great that game was.
2021, the year of the mom and dad gamer. I mean,
yeah. Oh
God. Metroid Dread?
Sure.
Halo Infinite? Resident Evil? Yeah. Well, no.
Oh, wait, we forgot about Game of the Year, It Takes Two.
All right, Resident Evil Village.
I am cool with that. I think Metroid Dread will always be the game of the year in my heart, but... You know, cool. I do love Resident Evil Village, and it wouldn't be besties if someone didn't leave a little bit disappointed.
Right. That's what Chris reminded me of going through the Game of the Year list. It's like, man, we've given a lot of fucking stellar games second place. So, yeah.
Man. So, congratulations. Can we say it?
Officially.
Yeah. Officially, congratulations, Resident Evil Village, 2021's Game of the Year. And God, Griffin, I'm so glad you flipped, because I was like 10 seconds away. Woo! 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 real nail biter there for me personally.
Thank you so much to the following people for writing these reviews on Apple Podcasts: Doodad 345, Will Gollyhue, Mystery Wizard, Rebe, and B Steffieri. Thank you for writing reviews. Thank you to everyone else who has written reviews over the last past couple weeks, as well as the last year. Yes. Hugely appreciate it. It's great to see. We always it helps us a lot, and it encourages us to continue doing the show.
And to recap the games that we talked about today: Metroid Dread, Wildermyth, Halo Infinite, Monster Hunter Rise, Inscription, Forza, Horizon 5, Unsighted, and our bestie Game of the Year 2021, Resident Evil Village. We also had honorable mentions for Kingdom 2 Crowns, Norselands, Binding of Isaac, Repentance, Before Your Eyes, Chicory, and Hitman 3. That is it. What a year. Another year in the books. We're entering year 10.
Wild.
Yes.
We are going to be on vacation next week. We're yes. all getting together, going to Cabo, baby. And we'll be back on January 7th with a new episode. We're going to be talking about games in 2022 that we're stoked out of our gourds for.
Be sure to join us for that. And be sure to always join us for the besties. Because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best games?
Besties!